I wonder, as you look at this, do you feel that the prevalence, because it is very prevalent in academia, in educational institutions, and so many elements of society, that the prevalence of the macroevolutionary, a completely material explanation for our origin, do you feel, Doctor, that that's had any impact on our society and our culture?
Well, we can look in the newspaper and find out what's going on when people have decided to not follow God and to not have a philosophy of why we are here and to whom do we belong. Because once we start to belong to ourselves, well, then it's easy to pull the trigger, so to speak. Life doesn't have meaning. You are a cosmic accident, and so is the guy in the car next to you, and so you pull a gun. See, all of a sudden we have, quote, lawlessness because we have rejected God's law. So does it affect society? Well, of course it does. There aren't any two ways around that. Within our own Christian societies, our own Christian churches, we still have lawlessness in there, and we see it. We try to rectify it. We try to have a committee to fix it because we know that we recognize that when we sin, we are rejecting God's love, God's law, and it only leads to the secularism, if you will. It just leads to everybody making their own laws for their own self, which is very selfish and self-centered, and that's what society has turned into. So does it affect us? It affects everything. It affects the movies we make. It affects the books we write. It affects an attitude of the heart and the heart that is degenerate. That's where it ends up.
Dr. Bruce Simmat is Associate Professor of Biology at University of Northwestern, St. Paul. And Doctor, of course, we want to let you go whenever you need to get going because you've got students to tend to and important educational material. But I do wonder, the debate in the schools, now I recall that you were involved with giving testimony down in Kansas, I believe, over the issue of what would be taught as a theory of origins in the schools. Is there any window or ray of light that intelligent design could perhaps make its way into school systems across the country, or is this pretty much in the same place that it's been?
Well, there have been overtures in the public schools to look at the data, especially on origins, and challenge what is being published in the biology textbooks. Because the biology textbooks on the origin of life are giving speculations based on a natural phenomena, and the natural phenomena is not helping them. So they talk about the early Earth and how monomers emerged, just simple molecules. It's a speculation of what would have to happen in order for evolution to occur. Then they have multiple hypotheses. I'm looking at my textbook as I speak. And I have the three main hypotheses in the textbooks. This is the college textbook that says how life might have started on this planet. And all of the verbs are it might have happened, it could have happened, it suggests, another one, it could have, it's possible, some might have been more capable than others, might have had a selective advantage. So the verbs are might have, could have, should have, seems to, must have. And there isn't one solid verb in the entire chapter because no one can even fathom how non-life could become life. Mm-hmm. So with that kind of scientific non-information, but the schools K through 12 have to teach a little bit more every year, right up until you're a senior in high school, of how nature might have done it, based on no information from science. So why are we teaching something that has no chance of happening? Well, because the alternative is unthinkable, as one evolutionist said. I have to believe in evolution because the alternative, I see, above nature, the alternative is unthinkable. So we must teach this because the alternative would be saying you were created. See, mm-hmm. Now, in Kansas, the Kansas State Board of Education challenged many members of the board, not all of them, challenged the paradigm of we're teaching this kind of natural origins from rock to rock stars, as a friend of mine once put it, that we're challenging that non-life can make life based on these scenarios in the textbook that certainly can't work. But we have to teach that and nothing else. Well, what if there's data, they ask, what if there's data to suggest that these things can't happen? Then we shouldn't be teaching that. We might have to teach that we don't know how we started here naturally. Aha, well, there's some data. The data says we haven't a clue. But we can't say that because then kids might think that we got here some other way than nature. See, we can't let them have a thought, a real discussion about origins. We have to indoctrinate them. So the Intelligent Design Organization challenged that at the state board level. And I and 23 others from around the country testified there in 2005. And all we did was show the data that says there is no information whatsoever about non-life elements ever becoming life. And everything that has been tried in a test tube in laboratories fails miserably because you have to have all of it there, all the proteins and carbohydrates and lipids and nucleic acids, all the complex molecules have to all be there working together under proper control. So after all that testimony, the Kansas Citizens for Science, which is the atheistic evolutionary camp, was allowed 2 weeks to bring in all the experts they wanted to refute anything we said. But all we said was right out of the data, right out of the research. So they'd have to be refuting all of the research. Well, they decided that there was nothing they could refute. So they boycotted. And they told the media, and I was reading this in the newspaper when I was down there testifying, they told the media, this group just wants to teach religion in the schools. That was their rebuttal. So they had no data. So the State Board of Education in Kansas then changed the wording in their mandate of how to teach science K-12 so that if you had data that refuted some of the claims of the textbook, you could teach that as long as it had data from a journal that was a refereed journal. Gee, like real science, perhaps. And they passed that. And that stayed on the books for the next 2 years. Within those 2 years, the Kansas Citizens for Science managed to get some of their people elected into the State Board of Education. And 2 years later, they voted to rescind all that language that would have opened up origins to actual investigation. And now you have to teach the textbook. I love it. Life on planet Earth.
Now, Doctor, you're someone who enjoys research, conducts much of it yourself. I wonder, in what you've read recently and observed, has there been research coming out of late that has intrigued you especially on this subject, or maybe even something that has challenged a supposition that you've held?
Well, on the subject of origins, there has been nothing coming forward that would challenge anything that would refute that this is really an intelligent design, that life, even one cell, is so complex. To make a point of that, let me just reference this. This particular semester right now, I am teaching developmental biology. That's conception to birth. So when you have a fertilized egg, you have one cell that's going to be a human or it's going to be a sea urchin. But whatever it's going to be, it is one fertilized egg. And all the information in there is for it to become an adult and a reproductive capable adult for the next generation. Well, there isn't a clue of how one cell can make trillions of cells of the human body, the billions of cells that are in the brain, you know, and a little pinky that curls up when you want it to. So the control mechanisms, what I've been reading lately is the DNA is one issue. It has all this information. It is the mode of information how to make a creature in this fertilized egg. But nobody has a clue at all of who's in control of the DNA. Who knows when certain genes should be turned on, turned off, how much, which cells, as the cells are developing. So we're reading in this developmental biology book how cells start to migrate. Nobody knows that they know how to go, where to go, when to stop, and then what to start producing when they get there. See, it just goes on and on and the authors are very upfront about this is way far beyond anything of complexity that we could imagine even creating. So we create a computer, and we call it a supercomputer, and we pat ourselves on the back. And one cell in your body is fantastically more complex than a supercomputer.
Wow.
So we don't know how that could happen, and we just say, we bow down before it and say, that isn't that remarkable? And now, where did it come from? So on the question of origins, more and more of this developmental biology, especially when we see the complexity of how, in what order, and how much, and how things develop, it is far beyond our not just our ability to understand, it is way more intelligent than us.
I find that comforting. That's fascinating stuff. Thanks again. You know, there have been some recent high-profile comments in more progressive evangelical circles to the effect that Genesis is more poetry, it's more symbolism, and it's much more that than a reliable story about how life begins. And what would be your response to that?
Well, the beginning of life, again, we don't have anything of any data of nature creating life from non-nature. So given any length of time, how long the earth was here, whether it was a molten ball cooling over billions of years, or whether God created it with a breath and it was in its present form overnight, it makes no difference. When you have a non-life and all of a sudden you have life, and it's so complex and so in control, otherwise it dies. So you cannot have a little bit of life, a semi-life. Everything that we have here, even in any cell that we have, it all works perfectly or it dies. It's all or none. You don't get a good debilitated cell that could just live and be fine, just fine, and reproduce itself for individual cells. And much less a multi-celled creature, which has to have all the functions. So, to look for any kind of a, or just acquiesce, if you will, acquiesce to societies, we must have some kind of a natural progression. The more I read about this, that God imbued into a living cell the ability to make changes, but all of our data says that the changes are virtually all negative. We don't get things better. But when you just back up even one more step and say origins, now we're not even talking mutations and evolution at all. We're just saying, how did this perfection of life get on this planet? From Watson and Crick fame, who first discovered the spiral DNA helix, Francis Crick wrote in the late 1990s, about 14, 15 years ago, that after studying DNA for 50 years, he said it is being the most complex molecule on the planet, and it's so complex and under so much control that we don't even have a clue how. He said it should not even be on this planet yet. If the planet is of life, if the life on this planet is 3.5-4 billion years old, is the estimate on the naturalism scale. If life on this planet is 3.5 or 4 billion years old, he said, DNA shouldn't even be here yet. He says, but here we are. Not just DNA showing up, but gee, look at us. You know, this fantastic human creature is here way before its time. So then he finished by saying, perhaps the DNA was seeded here by aliens. Yeah. So you go, wow, here's our preeminent atheistic evolutionist DNA geneticist, and he can't figure out how DNA gets here. So you boot it off into the universe and say, "Gee, it was able to create itself somewhere else because we can't figure out how it's created here." It bothers me in science that when scientists can't figure something out, you just make up a story. But it better be nature. So you hobble. You actually are tying up science when you say this is the only way you can look at science. You can only look at it through the eyes of a natural process because we will not entertain anything else. So when churches try to get on the bandwagon to be accepted by a naturalistic society, I think that's the death knell of that church.
Dr. Bruce Simad has kindly joined us on the road. And doctor, we do want to let you go. As people listen to you, they can tell you are a bright guy. I mean, you know your stuff. You've done your research. And yet, of course, as we've talked about throughout the interview, when a naturalist would talk about intelligent design and someone like you who ascribes to it, they would, hopefully they'd be kind to you and hopefully they'd be, you know, have a discussion with you that was effective and efficient, but they might tease you a little bit. Does it bother you at all to be in that position?
Well, I stand on the data. I have watched debates on tape and YouTube and et cetera, of atheists debating Christians and debating, shall we say, theists even, just that there must be a God who did this versus there can't be a God, right? And it turns out to be a bashing thing. The atheist does not have data to stand on, so they start to call names. Mm-hmm. All right. One is, you must have checked your brain at the door to not believe in evolution. See, well, there you go. At least my creator is intelligent, and their creator is sheer dumb luck from a rock. All right, somebody's got a problem here. So it's easy to debate this when you look at the data. All the name calling and everything else is a cover up and a sham when they don't have something to say intelligently.
Well said. Well, sir, thank you once again for your time, and I think a lot of people are really going to enjoy hearing about these things. It's something that's central to our faith, and I thank you very much. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the offer to come and talk.